Thank you for, I'm thrilled to be here and, it's always nice to be greeted by enthusiastic students at 9:30 in the morning, which is not my usual fate, in the university. So, consider, and the fact that it's Sunday is even more, is even more impressive. This, we're about to, we're in the week prior to Parshat Truma, and, I have to apologize in advance also. When I speak in English, I lapse into Ashkesvard, so there will be no consistency in the pronunciation of a Taf or a Suf and this type of thing, and I hope you'll be able to, you won't be totally confused thereby. We're in the week preceding Parshas Truma, and it's the week in which the lead mitzvah is the commandment to build a first a tabernacle in the desert and ultimately the Beis HaMikdash. Those who count the mitzvos, say for mitzvahs, for Sadyagon and others, do in fact see it all as one mitzvah. The pasuk in the first page of the sources, Va'asu li mikdash v'shachanti b'socham, that there is a commandment to build a sanctuary. Interestingly, the Torah does not speak about a mishkan initially. It speaks about a mikdash, which only emphasizes the fact that it's one long process of creating a central sanctuary wherein God's presence will be manifest and will indwell. Vishachanti b'socham, that I may dwell among them. Now, generally, when we discuss the issues of Mishkan and Mikdash, the major emphasis is upon the question of how does God, who fills the universe and is beyond the universe, we call him HaMakom because Hu Mikomo Shel Olam Ve'Ein HaOlam Mikomo, he is the place, he is the ultimate source of reality for the universe, and the universe cannot contain him. He is not the place of the universe is not his place. Question of the seeming inherent contradiction, which revolves around the question of creating a sanctuary and what does it mean that God indwells. That's the normal tack. Tack number two, and I'm not going to go there. Tack number two, less common and yet nevertheless not infrequently discussed, is the significance of the words Vishachanti b'socham, and I will dwell among them, in the sense of how does one maintain oneself in a state of awareness of God's presence. I guess I have to put a plug in for my new book. I don't dare plug it because it's an academic book and it costs 110 euros, so I can cite it without fear that you'll go run and buy it. The royalties are not, I'm not going to retire on the royalties, so you don't feel badly about that either. In the book that I recently published about the religious, the fabric, or the fabric of religious life in medieval Ashkenaz, I had opportunity to note the fact that throughout the ages, Jews had a very, very palpable sense of the presence of God in the synagogue. To the extent that when they would enter enter Shul, they would bow down towards the Aron, simply because of the feeling that God's Shekhinah was, as again, palpably present in the Shul. Perhaps it's a level of spiritual awareness we should still aspire to. But then again, that's not precisely the direction I want to go in. Hopefully the book will be in the Gottesman Library. You can take it out and read the second chapter and see more there. I want to emphasize another angle. And that is the question of what does it mean for there to be one central place wherein God's presence is focused? What does that mean in terms of the way that we organize ourselves, not just spiritually, but spiritually and geographically? In order to try to get that, to sharpen, or as where I come from, sharpen that question, I invite you to take a look at the second source. The Mishnah in Kalim, in the first parak, that's his Mishnah, it actually takes up four Mishnayos, 6 to 9, but I've only brought you two parts of two Mishnayos. Starts as follows. Eser Kedushos Hei. There are 10 levels of sanctity in the world. Eretz Yisrael Mekudeshes Mikol Haaretzos. Israel, Eretz Yisrael is more sacred than all other lands. One could even say that it is the only land that has inherent sanctity. Umahi Kedushasa. How does that sanctity find expression? Shemeviyin Mimena Haomer Vabikurim. Because one harvests from the land of Israel, the first wheat offering that is sacrificed right at, on the first day of Chol HaMoed Pesach. When I was younger, it wasn't that common, but now you can go through all kinds of Jewish neighborhoods and you find out that bakeries have big signs saying no Chodosh. What's Chodosh? The Torah says in Vayikra that if any grain, any wheat, which grows before Pesach cannot be consumed until after the Omer sacrifice is brought in the temple on the first day of Chol HaMoed Pesach, or in the absence of the Beis HaMikdash, until after the first day of Chol HaMoed Pesach. Then we start counting the same day. That's why it's called Sfiras HaOmer. We count to 50 days from the allowance of this wheat offering, or the first day, which actually is matir the wheat, 50 days, and then you come to Shavuos. So the unique sanctity of the land of Israel finds expression in the fact that the wheat which we use for that sacrifice has to be harvested in the land of Israel, and similarly we bring the first fruits from throughout the land of Israel. I'll come back to those two specific examples in a minute. Then the Mishnah goes on. I'm not going to go through every single stage. Different stages of intensity as one goes through different parts of Eretz Yisrael or different elements of the geography of Eretz Yisrael. Every single element, whether it's walled cities or so on, has more and more mitzvahs associated therewith until we come to Jerusalem. When you get to Jerusalem, there is sanctity that was within the city itself, and then there is Har HaBayis, and then there is this, and then there is that. That's what we're picking up. The Mishnah says Har HaBayis Mikudash Mimenu, that the Temple Mount has more intense sanctity than the city of Yerushalayim itself. She'ein Zavim V'Zavos Nidos V'Yodos Nichnasim L'Sham. Because a person who is a Zav, a person who is a Zava, a woman who has her period, a woman who's given birth, and also a man who has had an emission, cannot enter Har HaBayis unless they go to Mikvah. And then the Mishnah goes on and talks about the various steps towards the Beis HaMikdash, and concludes, Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, the Sanctum Sanctorum, is the holiest place on earth, Mikudash mehem shei nichnas l'sham ela kohen gadol b'yom kippurim b'shas ha'avoda, because only the high priest can enter there, and only during the specific part of the service on Yom Kippur, when he brings in the incense into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. If you take a look at the structure of this Mishnah and we turn it around, it then emerges that really sanctity starts in the Kodesh HaKadoshim and radiates out to all of Eretz Yisrael. You have one intense point, and then sanctity, Kedusha, radiates out until we get to the least, Kivayachu, the least sacred element, which is the land itself, from which one brings certain carbonos. Now, which brings us back, I'll come back to the significance of that in a second, which brings us back to the specific examples that the Mishnah cites. How do you know that Eretz Yisrael has Kedusha? Now, those of us who live in Israel know that if Kedusha is expressed through mitzvos, then there are a lot more mitzvos atlios baretz, there are a lot more commandments that find expression or that devolve upon the land of Israel than just bringing the Omer and Bikurim. Mikdash, Trumas, and Maestros, and Yovel, and Shemitah, and God knows, I mean, you have to see my backyard, what Shemitah did to my backyard last year. It still hasn't recovered, and it cries whenever I go outside. So why does the Mishnah zero in on these two mitzvahs? Why does it say that the sanctity of the land of Israel finds expression through Trumas and Maestros and all kinds of, and Orlah, whatever you want? Rav Soloveitchik, Zechet Tzadik Livracha, Mori Virabi pointed out that there's a fundamental distinction between the agricultural mitzvahs of Trumas and Maestros and these two mitzvahs that are mentioned in the Mishnah. What's the difference? Trumas and Maestros are mitzvahs which are related to agriculture and to harvesting. When one harvests, one must give some to the Kohen, must give some to the Levi, one must eat some in Yerushalayim, but they're mitzvahs which devolve upon the food and only upon the food. These two mitzvahs, Omer and Bikurim, are dinim and korbanos. They are inherently attached to the service in the temple, from which the Rav derived the conclusion that the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, which is described in the Mishnah, is not a Kedusha, is a Kedusha that is an extension of the Beis HaMikdash. In other words, the inherent sanctity of the land of Israel is an extension of Beis HaMikdash. It's like Eretz Yisrael is one big Beis HaMikdash in that regard. Meaning, again, coming back to the, therefore, the 10 levels, or 10 ascending levels of sanctity which the Mishnah describes are meant to express the fact that they draw, that the Kedusha that it devolves upon the Kodesh HaKodeshim is meant to draw you in towards the center. Because that's where everything starts. The idea that in fact the Kodesh HaKodeshim, that central point on Har HaBayis is the center where everything begins and everything ends, is an essential element to Jewish spirituality. Everything focuses around that point. Chazal gave an expression in this by saying that that's where the creation started. Because when you think about it, if you think about it in terms of Kabbalah, what is creation? All of a sudden, you become illiterate in two languages. Matzil. He emanates from himself a point, and from that point, the whole universe expands. Say Chazal, the Har HaBayis at that point where the Kodesh HaKodeshim is exactly where the world started. This is the connection between heaven and earth. This is where Tfilos go to heaven. Chazal called that point of Har HaBayis Tabur Shalom. It is the umbilical cord of the universe, which says the exact same thing. This is where it all starts. This is where it all begins. This is where it all ends. It's for that reason that Chazal, when they discuss the dream of Jacob in Beit El, say that for his prayer, when Yaakov says, "Ein zeh b'kein beis Elokim zeh shara shamayim," this must be the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. Chazal say that Yaakov Avinu was actually transported to Har HaBayis because all prayers must ultimately come to Har HaBayis, because that's where they ascend heavenward. But you don't need Chazal for that. In the next source, we have a few verses from the prayer that was offered by Shlomo Melech at the dedication of the first temple. This is Malachim Aleph Perikhes. We'll just look at the psukim that I've actually put in bold. Liyosei Necha, he prays to God that your eyes, Liyosei Necha Psuchos al HaBayis Hazeh, Laila Vayom el HaMokam Asher Amarta Yeshmi Sham, L'shmoa el HaTfila Asher Yispalel Avdecha L'makom Hazeh. Your eyes should always be upon this house, because your servant, meaning Shlomo in this case, will pray El HaBayis Hazeh. He's not praying to the building. He's directing his prayers toward the building, because that's the shoot which connects heaven and earth. Or v'shamata estchinas avdecha v'amcha Yisrael sheyispalu el mokam hazeh. All of Israel will pray towards this place. A person who's in pain, uparas kapa de labayas hazeh. And what's the halacha? The halacha is we all know that you're supposed to face east when you daven. But there's no halacha facing east. I know that the rusty brick sitter has a compass and says east. That's not it. The din is called nochach hamikdash, facing the mikdash when you daven. So therefore, if you're in the west, you face east. When I was in Hong Kong, the shul faced west. I live in Efrat, the shul's face north. When I dive in the university, we face south. Then in Mizrach, I mean, therefore some people sit in the Dorum Vant, when they sit on the southern wall when they're in shul. But rather than directing your prayers towards the Mikdash because of that moment. Now the awareness that everything must be directed towards that point in Har Habayis, wherein sits the site of the Shechina, of the Kodesh HaKadosh, the site of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and where the Shechina still dwells, we'll come back to that, is not just an aspect of tefillah. It is a fundamental, formative moment in Jewish spirituality through the ages. We have become slothful, in that regard. But up until relatively recently, the awareness of the Beis HaMikdash was the formative moment in Jewish spiritual awareness and God awareness. How do I know? I know because of a number of different factors. Number one, I'll give you one literary example and one artistic example. The literary example is, as Gemara in Yevamos says, that debates the question of what should be the postures of prayer. Should you look up when you pray, or should you look down when you pray? We paskin that when you pray, you should look down. But not because of humility. It's interesting. Rashi says because you should look down, because by looking down, you should think about having your prayers transported to the Beis HaMikdash. And in fact, Hasidi Ashkenaz, the pious of Germany in the 12th century, emphasized the fact that when you pray, you should try to visualize the Beis HaMikdash in front of you. That's one. Even more palpable, I think, is the fact that shuls were organized to adumbrate and to inspire people to feel transported to the Beis HaMikdash. I submit for your consideration the picture which appears on page 1, which I took off of the internet. This is of the front view of the Dura Europas Synagogue. Now, Dura Europas is a town in eastern Syria, in eastern Syria. At the time that it was built, in the lifetime of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the end of the period of the Mishnah, the beginning time of the period of the Gemara, it was on the eastern reaches of the Roman Empire, near the Parthian border. All right. Today it's in Syria. It was actually destroyed in 244. That's why we know, because we know from other historical sources. Today, the city of Dura Europas has unfortunately undergone the fate meted out by the Dawla al-Islamiyya, you know it as ISIS, and has been somewhat flattened. Happily, or at least in the meantime, the panels of the synagogue that they uncovered in Dura Europas are in the Central Museum, Damascus. Let's hope that they are preserved. This is one of the most elaborately decorated synagogues in the world. Its wall paintings are absolutely stunning. I invite you to, in fact, look on the net to see them up close because they are stunning isn't even the word. They're jaw-droppingly beautiful. They have given a tremendous amount aroused a tremendous amount of interest among art historians. But that's not my purpose right now. The Dura Europas Synagogue was built under the influence of Eretz Yisrael. We'll come back to why that's important. And at the same time, has certain Babylonian elements as well. So it's where the two traditions sort of merge. I call your attention at the moment to the top two lines of panels. If you look carefully, the two lines of panels above the ark, if you take a close look, what is portrayed there is, in imagination of course, but still, portrayed there is the city of Jerusalem and the Beis Hamikdash. Why that? And why there? The answer is very simple. It's not just commemorative. Usually we put a painting up that's commemorative of something else. When you go in, I check this with a number of art historians, because I'm just an amateur in this part of the field. I check with a number of art historians who told me that when you go into these synagogues, which are actually illustrated and decorated from all sides, the idea was that you should be drawn into the shul and taken out of your initial context, and you are transported to another dimension. The fact that the Beis HaMikdash and Yerushalayim and various sacrificial elements and so on are portrayed above the ark, and they draw your attention forward, the function of those wall paintings is to say, this is where you are. You are no longer in Dura Europas. You are now in the Beis HaMikdash, because that's where the Tfilos end up coming. And sending the message that when we call a shul a mikdash me'at, a smaller sanctuary, it doesn't mean a replacement or a temporary dwelling for prayer, but rather, to use internet language, a portal to the Beis HaMikdash. Now, which means that the experience of being in the Beis HaMikdash and of being opposite the Kodesh HaKodeshim is a permanent element of Jewish spirituality. And that continues. First of all, it's true of almost all the shuls that were built in Eretz Yisrael in the ancient period. You may have visited the shul in Bir Am in the north, or the shul in Meiron. If you've gone to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, you see that the entry to the shul has three gates. There's a big gate in the middle and two small gates on each side. That was meant to invoke and to mimic the way that the front of the Beis HaMikdash was built, which had a big gate in the middle and two gates on either side. You couldn't more powerfully invoke that memory, that association, that experience. And as I say, all shuls in Germany and in France and in Poland and later on even in Sephardic countries were infused with this awareness of the temple, of its centrality, and the fact that one is drawn into a dimension where which one is expected to try to experience what it means to be in the Beis HaMikdash. Now, from an experiential point of view, underlying this self-organization around the Beis HaMikdash is an existential moment. Let me explain. In 1975, I had the privilege of learning with Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal from 1973 until 1982. In those days, I was still living in Boston and learning with him there. 1975, though, the shir here in New York learned Chulin, and the Rav, and they finished the first parak in Chulin. So they asked the Rav to say a few words on the occasion of finishing the parak. And he said as follows. He signaled out the next text that I have on page one, the fact that when we finish a Masechta, we finish Mishnayos, whatever we finish something significant in terms of learning, we always close with the same formula. Hadron Alach Maseches, or Sefer, whatever it is, we will return to you whatever book was learned. Bahadra Chalan, you'll return to us. Datan alach maseches, and we think of you. We will not abandon you. Lotus nashim menach, neither in this world nor in the next world. What do you mean we will never leave you? I mean, so you learn brachas, and now you got to learn sukkah, and now you got to learn baba kama and baba menachas. Why? What do you mean I will return? Maybe I hope you return to you, but what do you mean we'll never forget you? What is this? What is this loyalty? This is not Cyril de Bergerac writing love poems to Roxanne. What's he mean here? So the Rav didn't invoke Cyrano de Bergerac. Just for those of you who were wondering. I mean, he could have, but he didn't. He certainly was aware of Cyrano de Bergerac. The Rav said, because a Jew has a sixth sense, he is automatically drawn to Kedusha. He knows when it's there. Like a magnet, it draws him in. That's a permanent moment in Jewish spirituality. So it's not to be, it's not at all surprising, in fact, that Jews organized themselves around the Beis HaMikdash, even in Golos, because they knew where reality, where ultimate reality was found. Interestingly, in Germany and in the United States, when non-Orthodox movements wanted to detach Jews from that magnet which draws one to Kedusha, they redefined Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim, and by extension the Beis HaMikdash, in local terms. The founder of Reform Judaism was famously said, Cincinnati is our Jerusalem, and America is our Palestine, and Cincinnati is our Jerusalem. Now, I've been to Cincinnati. It's a lovely town, and I don't want to insult people, whatever. This is not it. In any event, the point is that the attachment, the awareness of Harabayas and the Beis HaMikdash is a permanent, it never went into disuetude. It was a permanent moment of Jewish spirituality always. End of part one. So if that's the case, if it's so central, we'll have to ask the question, should you go there or should you not go there? If it's the place to be and everything else is simply the antechamber, what about actually going to Har HaBayit? Now, you are, I'm sure, all very well aware of the fact that the past 6 months have been very difficult for us in Israel. It's really not relevant. We are a very difficult time of an upsurge of terror, which started against the background of the accusation that Al-Aqsa Mosque is in danger, that we want to blow up the mosque and build a Beis HaMikdash. We'll see in a minute that's ridiculous because Al-Aqsa Mosque is not even on Har HaBayis, and so on. Or that the very presence of Jews on Har HaBayis is a provocation, as the was voiced by serious American representatives and even the Israeli police chief. So let's ask the question, nevertheless, central question here is our relationship with Har HaBayis, can you go there? I mean, it would seem to be that if it's the most holy place, we should try to go. So normally when you ask people, I know if I ask, there are some people I ask, they start shaking and get upset and so on, but it's not an upset, it's a halakhic issue, we can discuss it. Usually the discussion begins on page 2, and revolves around a famous machlokas between the Rambam and the Raivin. The Rambam, in Hilchos Beis HaBechira, when he lays out the laws regarding the building of the temple, because he assumes that the mitzvah of Asuli Mikdash Shechanti Besocham is a mitzvah forever, and in fact the Rambam explicitly said that the Beis HaMikdash will be built by the Mashiach. Interestingly, if you don't mind my digressing, one of the more interesting moments that I had when I was writing this book that I told you about. One of the things I talk about a lot is this relationship between the Beis HaMikdash and a shul. I happened to be looking at the time at the Sefer Yerayim, which was written in the last third of the 12th century by Rebbe Elazar of Metz, who was the premier student of Rabbeinu Tam in France, Germany, on the border. The book is a collection of me. He describes all the mitzvahs and gives the halachas regarding each separate mitzvah. And as I'm looking, the one mitzvah he doesn't count, or one of the major mitzvahs he doesn't count, is the mitzvah to build the Beis HaMikdash. But what's odd is that he's got everything else. That you have to guard the Beis HaMikdash, you have to be marked with korbanos. It made no sense to me. I mean, everything else is there except having a Beis HaMikdash. So what was he thinking? So I actually discussed this with my teacher and now colleague and esteemed friend, Rabbi Dr. David Berger. And he suggested something which left me absolutely stunned, but he's absolutely right. There is a machlokas apparently between the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim as to who builds the Beis HaMikdash. The Sephardim hold with the Rambam that in fact the Beis HaMikdash will be built by men. On the other hand, the Ashkenazim apparently thought, they accepted the opinion, Rashi cites it in Sukkah and he cites it in Peirush on Chumash, that the third Beis HaMikdash will come down from heaven. Totally complete. So the Urayim, since he holds that way, says there's no mitzvah to build the Beis HaMikdash, God will build it. We have to do the maintenance. It's always a problem, by the way. You get a building donated, they'll put the name on the building, but the maintenance and the furniture and everything else, that they won't provide. So the Torah here, according to the Urayim, is we have to worry about says the mitzvah is to do the maintenance. God will actually build the Beis HaMikdash, which is actually a good thing, because my nightmare is that if it's built by Basar Vidam, you'll never see it because every single brick will have a plaque on it. And every single stuff, you'll probably never see it because it'll all be, you know, and some guy will have 10 bricks and 40 bricks and you'll have what are they called? The campaigns to raise money. It's better than Bar Shalom's building. In any event, I'm sure it'll be perfect. In any event, the Rambam, in the context of discussing the building of the Beis HaMikdash, discusses the question of, okay, once you have a Beis HaMikdash, can you extend the territory, the area which it encompasses, and instill in that area the Kedusha which devolves upon the Beis HaMikdash? The Gemara in Shavuos discusses this at length. The Rambam says that Bizman Hazeh, meaning from Bayis Sheni on, there is no such capacity, and any extensions to the original area of Har HaBayis and the Beis HaMikdash do not have inherent sanctity because we lack a king and we lack Urim Bitumim and so on and so forth. And when they would do the ceremonies, when they expand the platform of the Beis HaMikdash, it was simply a commemorative thing. It had no halachic valence. Nevertheless, says the Rambam, the Beis HaMikdash proper, look at the last line of the Rambam here, Bamin is Skadsha, when was the Temple Mount sanctified? Vikdusha Rishona. At the time of Shlomo Melech, Shekidsha Shlomo, last line in the Rambam in the square letters, Shekidsha Shlomo, Shehu Kidesh HaAzara, Shlomo Melech was sanctified the Beis HaMikdash proper, by extension Har HaBayis, V'Yerushalayim L'Shaton, for at the time, Ulasid Lavo. In other words, the Kedusha of Har HaBayis and the Kedusha of the Beis HaMikdash are forever in stark contrast to the kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, which actually was invalidated when the temple was destroyed in 586 and reinstituted by Ezra. Nevertheless, says the Rambam, the kedusha of Har HaBayis, the kedusha of Beis HaMikdash stays forever, and as a result, the restrictions of entry to Har HaBayis and to the Mokum HaMikdash remain in force forever. What are those restrictions? The restrictions are these. That when it comes to the area of the temple proper, a person who is Tamei Meis cannot enter. Otherwise he's Chayev Kares. Bizman HaZeh, there's no Paraduma, and as a result, we're not allowed to go in the area of the Beis HaMikdash proper. We saw already in the Mishnah that when it comes to Har HaBayis, which we have not located yet, but when it comes to Har HaBayis itself, then a Tamei Meis is allowed to go to Har HaBayis, but a person who is either a Zav or a Zav or a Yoledes or a Nida or a Valkeri cannot go unless they go to Mikvah. Whether they need to wait until the next day after they go to Mikvah, or they can go the day that they actually go to Mikvah is another issue. Generally, the accepted opinion is that all you need to go to Mikvah, and you don't have to wait for nightfall. But by the way, we just have women here, so I can tell you though that when I first went to Har HaBayis, and we'll talk about that in a minute, it's not just like men go to Mikvah on Erev Yom Kippur, they dunk in, and it's, you know, this bonding experience or whatever. It's not so bonding. I got news for you, it's like being in the Packers locker room after a game. But it requires a real, a real effort. So guys find out that they have to learn how to clip their fingernails and comb and this and that and the other thing. And I know more than one wife was told, her husband, who was going up to Har Habayis the first time, saying, after he was complaining, saying, excuse me. You do it once in a yovel. At least now maybe you'll appreciate me more. In any event, that's the Rambam Shita. The Ravid did not agree. The Ravid says, I don't know where he gets this. He says, I think that in fact there is no more Kores in the Mokam HaMikdash. He says, since we don't have time, I'll just tell you what he says. He says that Ezra knew that the Beis HaMikdash was going to be destroyed, and therefore he made the Kedusha that he instilled in the Har Habayis and the Mokam HaMikdash, he made it conditional, and as a result, there's no more Kedusha. He says, HaNichnas Ata Sham Ein Bo Kores. There is no punishment. There are those who want to say it may be prohibited, but this doesn't have any kind of penalty. Most Mefarshim are not of that opinion. The Meiri, for example, says that in his day, the position of the Ravid was accepted, and people would walk around on Har Habayis on the Makom HaMikdash. The Meiri lived in late 13th, early 14th century. Nevertheless, over time, the position of the Rambam was accepted. The Magen Avraham, famous commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, says explicitly, last line, the imkein divrei Rambam shririm v'kayomim. Therefore, we see that the words of Maimonides are established, firmly established. Vanichnas ato lemokam hamikdash. If you go into the Mokam HaMikdash today, you're chayav kores pshahak shekulanu tmei mason. Okay, beseder. But that only begs the question. There's more to Har Habayis than the Mokam HaMikdash. We'll come back to where these things are in a minute. Going into the Har Habayis itself, what's the problem? You go to Mikveh, you go to Har Habayis. And I'll tell you something else. Based on the Rambam we just saw, Har Habayis, take a look at the map I have on the last page. The area in the trapezoid in red is the outline of Har Habayis as we have it today. Okay? That is not Har Habayis. That is a huge area that was extended by Herod as part of his renovations of the Beis HaMikdash, which he started in his lifetime in the first decade before the Common Era, and only was completed a couple of years before the Chorban. That was how big a deal it was. I'm going to assume that the outlines here are correct, because I think they are. Anything outside of that yellow line in the middle, which are the parameters of Har Habayis proper, alright, are extensions by Herod. Herod lived in the Bayis Sheni. The Rambam says explicitly, is there sanctity to anything that is extended or built at the time of Bayis Sheni? The Rambam says explicitly, no. Okay? So anybody could go in the area outside of the yellow line. Tmeim, no tmeim, doesn't matter. The irony is, if you take a look at the lower left-hand side of the trapezoid, which says Bayasheni, see the words? And that left-hand corner, that's Al-Aqsa. That's the mosque that they keep talking about. So ironically, it's not on Har Habayis. It's not on Har Habayis. I mean, it's an amazing place. I mean, I haven't been. I see it from the outside, but it's not a Har Habayis. All right, we'll come back to that in a minute. So, did Jews go on to Har Habayis, even if they avoided the Mokam HaMikdash? There is every indication to think that they did. Take a look at the next text. This is from a kind of an odd book by a thinker, astrologer, astronomer, physician named Rabbi Avraham Bar Chiya Nasi, who lived in the late 12th century in Barcelona. It's important to think about Barcelona because Barcelona was a major port city, a major cosmopolitan center, and there was a lot of communication back and forth between Eretz Yisrael and Spain at the time. He is bemoaning the fact that in his lifetime, Jews had been banished from Yerushalayim. In fact, when the Crusaders came to conquer Jerusalem in 1099, they camped on the hill where the Rockefeller Museum is today, opposite Herod's Gate. They broke in. The first thing they encountered was the Jewish quarter. They took all the Jews, according to the Chronicles, put them in the shul, locked the shul, and burned the shul to the ground. Later on, the Crusaders bragged, one of the Crusaders bragged about the fact that they killed so many infidels that the blood went all the way up to their thighs, or their knees, I don't remember exactly right now. I mean, they weren't big tzaddikim, the Crusaders. And one of the things they did was to make sure that that Jerusalem was Judenrein. By contrast, Rabbi Avraham ben Barchiya writes here, line 1, Ukimalchein, similarly, Hayu Malchein Yishma'elim Noagim Imam Min Haktov. The Muslims dealt, well with us. They were actually quite gracious to us. Behirshu Yisrael Lavo El Abayis. They let us go to the house. We'll see what that means. V'livnos bo beis tefila u'medrash. They let them build both a yeshiva and a shul on Har Abayis. V'hayu kol galuyos Yisrael akrovim El Abayis olim elav b'chagim u'v'moadim u'mispalim b'socho u'ma'amidim tefilosom k'neged t'midim u'musofim. And Jews would go, they would gather there in Yontif and Shabbos and so on, and they would offer up their prayers near the Beis HaMikdash in tribute to the fact that instead of the Korbanos, so that's what they would do. So did Jews go up? Yes. So maybe you'll say, okay, but they don't like the Rabbi. We don't like the Rabbi anymore, not only the Rambam. Next paragraph. In 1165, the Rambam and his family, who had been oppressed by the Al-Mukhadim who had forced Jews to convert to Islam in Spain and North Africa, managed to escape, and they made it to Eretz Israel. And the Rambam says the following, in a letter which is debated as to whether authenticity. Today, there is every reason to think this letter is authentic. V'leil echad v'shabbos, on Sunday evening, shlosha yamim le'yerach sivan, the third of Sivan, yatzasi min hayam, I embarked from the sea, b'shalom, ubanu la'ako, v'nitzalti min hashmad v'ganu le'Eretz Yisrael. I was saved from the persecution, and we got to Eretz Yisrael. The Rambam then says that he has decreed forever in his family, there should be a day of festivities on the third of Sivan, in honor of their salvation. Let's call it Purim Ramba. Then he writes about his life and so on. He says, Ubayom Shlishi on Tuesday, Bishabis Arboyamim Lechodesh Yerech Mar Cheshvan, on the fourth of Cheshvan, Shnas Shishav Esrim Laitzir, now 11:26, Yatsanu Me'aka, we left Akka, which is where they first landed, La'alos Yerushalayim Tachas Sakana, but the roads were difficult. This is the time of the major wars between the Ayyubids, Al-Salah ad-Din, or actually Salah ad-Din's father, and the Crusaders. It wasn't pushed to go on the roads. And he says, V'nichnasti la'bayas ha'godol v'akonos l'spalalti bo. And I went into the great house and I prayed there on the sixth of Cheshvan. So what is that? What's he referring to? There were those who say, it's a big shul. However, the Rambam, one of the things that my teacher, Professor Twersky Zafzal, used to emphasize is the fact, the Rambam is very, very consistent in his use of language. And when he talks about Habayis HaGadol V'Kadosh, if we want to know what it means, we have to look where other places he uses the words to see what he's referring to. Take a look at the Rambam, Hilchos Bias Mikdash Parakala Chachid Zayin. The Rambam here is talking about proper deportment in the Beis HaMikdash. He says, if you're a schlumper, if you're fashnushkit, if you're drunk, if you didn't get a haircut, he says, if you're dressed in an inappropriate way, afa pisha ein ba'ena bazhara, even though such a person who walks in the Beis HaMikdash under those circumstances, he doesn't violate a law, she'ein zekovet umara labayis hagodol v'kodosh yikanos bokach. It's not appropriate, it's not dignified to walk into the Bayis HaGadol V'Kadosh in such a state. So what does the Bayis HaGadol V'Kadosh refer to? Beis HaMikdash. So hello, the Rambam in the previous section says you're Chayav Kares if you walk into the Beis HaMikdash. So the answer appears to be that the Rambam is referring in the letter to the Bayis HaGadol V'Kadosh not to the Makom HaMikdash proper, but to Har HaBayis. Because it's enveloped by the because very frequently Har HaBayis and Makom HaMikdash are used interchangeably. And in fact, to this day, there are many who celebrate, who observe on the 6th of Cheshvan, the anniversary of the Rambam's entry to the Beis HaMikdash. That was the day that my friend Yehuda Glick was actually shot, and that was the day that they actually had his Sudas Hoda'ah a year later. Okay? So did Jews go into Har HaBayis? Absolutely. Did they daven there? Absolutely. That raises the question of Muslims. We'll get there in a minute. Why were they able to go? That leads us to the question of, actually, the Muslim, as I said, the Islamic issue. So, historically speaking, apparently, the Muslim rulers of Jerusalem, in the 10th, then the 11th, and the, well, they weren't Muslims in the 12th century, did not object to Jews praying in on Har HaBayis, either because they did not see it as a threat, or they did not attribute that much significance to the Har HaBayis. Okay. However, starting with the family of Salah ad-Din, the Ayyubids, followed by the Seljuks, followed by the Mamluks, followed by the Ottomans, the Islamic religious position shifted. And Jews were barred, not just from Har HaBayis, but from every single sacred place that was sacred to the Jews. It was at that point that Jews were barred from Maras and Machpelah also.
Why did you say?
Oh, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. Thank you for the question. That's precisely what I want to address right now. In order to understand what happened, it's important for us to get a sense of what was the play, the role of Jerusalem in Islam. So everybody knows to say Jerusalem is the third most sacred city in Islam. It's not true. It's not true. First of all, it is certainly not the third most sacred city in Islam according to the Shiites, because their most sacred city is outside of Karbala, which is where the Imam Hussein was killed in at the end of the 7th century. He's their Mashiach. Okay, direct descendant of Muhammad, and so on. All right, so that's definitely not true. What about the Sunni? So here the question arises, does Jerusalem have any status in Islamic law? Number one, Jerusalem is not mentioned in the Quran anywhere. Jerusalem is hardly mentioned in the authentic hadith, that's the Torah Shebaalpeh. When it is called that, when it is referred to, it is called Ilya, which is the Ilya Capitolina, the name that was given to it by Herod. There was a period of time when Muhammad tried to attract the Jews of Medina to Islam, that he said the prayer, direction of prayer, instead of to Mecca, which is their Kodesh HaKadoshim, should be towards Jerusalem, the Qibla, the direction of prayer, their Nochach HaMikdash. The Jews didn't take the bite, so he shifted it back. In fact, there's an authentic hadith in which an early Jewish convert to Islam continues to pray to Allah, but towards Jerusalem, and one of the early followers of Muhammad says to him, oh, you see, you're Judaizing. You haven't been able to get away from your roots, because we no longer pray towards Jerusalem. That was just a temporary thing. You have to pray to Mecca. In other words, there is a nullification, there's a negation of prayer towards Jerusalem in the early tradition. Everything focuses upon, I'm in shul, so I'm not going to recite a verse from the Quran. You can read it. There's a limit to even what I can do. The Quran describes that Muhammad got in his horse, Al Burak, and went up to the farthest mosque. The question is, where is that at night? Historically speaking, it's probably a mosque southeast of Mecca, Masjid Al Aqsa, the one at the edge. The predominant interpretations in the first part of the Muslim era, in the first part of the 7th century, identified this mosque as being in heaven somewhere. It was only later, there's a minority opinion that said that it might be Jerusalem, and from there Muhammad went up to heaven. One of the more cynical members of the Hebrew University faculty, he just passed away not long ago, the late Professor Tzvi Rublevsky once said, you see from that there are no direct flights from Mecca to heaven, you have to have a stop layover in Jerusalem. But Jerusalem was not on the agenda, ever. What happened? The end of the 7th century, the first major Muslim dynasty took over, the Umayyads. But their capital was in Damascus. And Muawiyah, the fifth caliph, did not control Mecca and Medina. So he needed a Mokum Kadosh for validation and for tourism and whatever. So he decided to declare that Yerushalayim was actually where the Masjid Al-Aqsa was. So he was the one who sponsored the building of the initial version of Al-Aqsa Mosque and also the Dome of the Rock. And he encouraged tourism, and Jerusalem was praised, and it was a big push to make Jerusalem central. In 750, the Abbasids wiped out the Umayyads, except for one prince who ran to Spain, moved the capital to Baghdad, and you know what happened? Jerusalem was forgotten. It's not mentioned, it's not discussed, Gornish with Gornish. Until the Crusaders come. And then Salah ad-Din and his father, Nur ad-Din, decide that they have to, in order to be able to get everybody's lather up, that they have to restore Jerusalem to its luster, and they start pushing, hacking away at the fact that Jerusalem is important. That's part of the reason why you see a shift between letting Jews in the 11th century and the 12th century daven and harabayit, and what happens with the Ayyubids and those that come after. But it's more than that. There are different strains in Islamic law and theology that address the question of what is the relationship, what is the status of those religions that preceded Islam. Namely, Judaism, Christianity, and actually Mazdaism. Everybody know what Mazda? It's not related to the car. Mazdaism is the ancient religion of Persia, which is also considered to be have validity at some stage prior to the appearance of Muhammad. Anybody know who the most famous Mazdian is today? For Jews anyways? Zubin Mehta. Everybody knows who Zubin Mehta is, right? Yeah, okay. Good. I would be very upset. M-A-Z-D-A. Because their central god is Ahura Mazda, the god of light. The truth is, it's problematic, but I haven't got time to go into that right now. Okay. There are several different approaches. Some approaches say that with the coming of Muhammad, that the previous revelations became annulled. They're no longer valid, but they have some standing because they used to be valid. The preeminent and predominant line today is, okay, that life is binary. Islam started with Ibrahim al-Rahim, with Abraham, who tried to sacrifice his son Ismail on the Kaaba in Mecca. That all of the prophets of Israel were not prophets of Israel, they were Muslims. Nabi Musa, and Nabi Dawood, and Nabi Isa, they were all Muslims. You were either Muslim, or you were kafir. Just as the world is divided between Dar al-Islam and Dar al-Harb, the world of Islam that is under Islamic rule, and the world that will become Muslim by virtue of struggle, which is called jihad. I know what I'm saying is totally not politically correct, but it's true. This, in the same way, you're either Muslim, you're either in or you're out. You're either part of what is called the Din al-Haq, the religion of truth, but the Din al-Bar, the religion of law, of falsehood, of lies. And they go together. Dar al-Harb is the world of Bada. Dar al-Islam is the world of Haq, of truth. Therefore, for a person, and therefore, all places that are sacred, by definition, must be Muslim. Har-Habayit must be exclusively Muslim. Maras al-Makhtayla must be exclusively Muslim. And over the past 20 years, Kever Rachel, which they never wanted, must be exclusively Muslim. The same thing with churches. They built this mosque in front of the Church of the Annunciation in Nazareth. All knows that it's a principal position. It's not sympathy for us, but it's a principal position. This is the approach which began gaining speed in the late 12th century, and it's predominant and preeminent exclusively, at least in the Middle East, and not just today. Hence, Jewish presence on Har HaBayit is by definition blasphemous. That's why prayer is considered to be, you know, like if Jews assert, or Christians for that matter, assert prayer in Maris HaMachpelah or in Har HaBayis, that is a threat to the very essence of Islam. But it's coterminous with the question of Jewish residence in Eretz Yisrael, because Eretz Yisrael, as far as the Muslims are concerned, is part of the Dar of Islam. It has Kedushas Aguf, and the fact that Kafir, the fact that heretics live there, or rule there, not under restricted terms of the Zimma, which is another topic, is blasphemy by itself. Bottom line, there is no, that fundamentally and conceptually, the question of Har HaBayis for the Muslim is precisely the same question of the existence of the State of Israel. Of the existence of the State of Israel. Ironically, from a halachic point of view, we have no problem. The Rambam says explicitly, Islam is not a void of Zara. You can daven in a mosque. I mentioned this once to somebody, to a very sort of very yeshivish individual, who got very upset. And I said, but it's an offener Rambam, you know, it's not, and besides, I said, do you daven in Maris HaMachpelah? Of course. Hello, have you looked around at the decorations? Do you daven in Kever Shmuel HaNavi? Of course. Have you seen how it's organized? It's a mosque, guys. Oh, wow. So we're actually sharing Har HaBayis is certainly within our is certainly legitimate. Okay, that was my last point. Thank you for asking. excuse me. Why do people not go? Why do people not go, if that's the case? There are two general justifications to why not go. Justification number one, I find somewhat flimsy, I will tell you. They say that if Jews were to go up, if religious Jews were to go up to Har HaBayis, then non-religious Jews would go to Har HaBayis and not go to Mikveh first, and that would, the most Jews going, religious Jews would lead to non-religious Jews going and being mechalel, desecrating the place. But that's a non-starter, because as it is, non-religious Jews go all the time. The only people that, in fact, that ruling would prevent from going to Har HaBayis are Jews who would go to Mikveh and go up to Kedusha v'Tahara to be Nana Miziv HaShechina. So that doesn't make any sense. The other argument is more cogent, and that is that we don't know, ostensibly, where the Makom HaMikdash was. In other words, yeah, it's true, you can go to Har HaBayis, but we don't know exactly where Har HaBayis was, or what condition it is. It's a suffix, it's their colors, don't go. That's the argument. There is something to that argument. It actually speaks to the question of Masorah, which is so much rooted around lately on other issues, primarily feminist. There have been no extensive archaeological examinations on Har HaBayis, but in the 19th century there were, and there were some preliminary studies done after 67. The issue really isn't where is the Beis HaMikdash. The question really is, where isn't the Beis HaMikdash? Because that's where you can go. So if you look on the map on the third page, all right? Based on the layout of the stones and of the mountaintop that underlies the platform and a number of other considerations, most archaeologists are convinced that the Beis HaMikdash itself is more or less confined to the long rectangle in the middle, where you see the Dome of the Rock on the western edge, and that around it is an area of 500 square cubits, which aligns almost perfectly with the dimensions of the Beis HaMikdash that are mentioned in the Mishnah in Midos and in other sources, and according to Josephus, they have that kind of haskama. That's pretty amazing. There are even side proofs which are incredibly moving. The Torah says that when the Paraduma was burnt, that it had to be burnt Pesach Oel Moed, opposite, over against the entry to the Beis HaMikdash. We know from the Gemara and from other sources that in fact they used to make the Paraduma on Har HaZeisim. If you stand in front of Shaar HaRachamim and you look on one side to the Dome of the Rock, and you turn around and you face Har HaZeisim, you can see on the mountain a carved out flat area, which is precisely in line with what apparently was the entry to the Beis HaMikdash, and where most historians think the Paraduma was burnt and prepared. Amazing moment. On the other hand, those who go on Har HaBayis rely on the historians on the argument that there may not have been a direct Masorah up until now, but if you have objective, historical, physical facts in front of you, you can paskin accordingly. Those who say you need a Navi, don't go. There is another consideration. Okay, and I will tell you, I learned for 9.5 years with Rav Soloveitchik, and his fundamental ritual and liturgical conservatism is very much part of, with a small c, is very much part of my spiritual makeup. I struggled long and hard before I decided to go to Har HaBayit the first time. It was only after I was absolutely 100% convinced of this reconstruction of where the Beis HaMikdash was and was not that I went. As you see, when you come into Har HaBayit, a lot of the walking around is actually outside of the Har HaBayit itself, the mountain. The Astravarn Lichtenstein's itself about this. And he reputedly said as follows. There were those who are Matir, and there were those who are Asir. He himself doesn't go because he feels that he's spiritually not on that level. On the other hand, other Ramim and Haritzion do go. So it's an open question. I can only tell you that the assertion of our connection with Har HaBayis is the fulfillment of that magnet to Kedusha, and that there is no more, I have never had a more transformative experience in my life as going to Har HaBayis and standing B'Mokam HaShechina. You don't really need to daven because there aren't words. There really aren't words. Certainly, however, whether one goes up or one doesn't go up, that's a halakhic issue, should be taken up with a competent posek and an expert as well on this specific issue. Nevertheless, the fact that Har HaBayis and the Mokam HaMikdash are at the center of our religious lives again is certainly a salutary thing, because the Torah says in Truma, V'asuli Mikdash, B'shachanti B'socham, and as the Rambam says, whether there's a Beis HaMikdash built there or not, Shechina, Eina V'teila, the presence of God there is always there. L'shichno tidrishu uvasa shama. You should seek out the Shechina and come there, hopefully, to live. Good morning. Yes, questions? I'm sorry? I can't hear you. Rav Lichtenstein Zatzal did not go. But other Ramim in Haritzion Dafkadu, Rav Meidan, for example, is aggressively involved in going to Har HaBayis. Rav Tendler does not go to Yerushalayim, does not go to Israel without going to Har HaBayis at least once. In fact, there's an interesting, somebody made a YouTube of him walking around on Har HaBayis in order to, Rav Moshe, by the way, there is serious reason to think that Rav Moshe was matir going to Har HaBayis, because he was asking one question whether about comportment on Har HaBayis, and Rav Moshe says, yes, all of the dinim of proper comportment on Har HaBayis apply. The implication being that there's no reason not to go per se as long as you behave. Yes? No. This has been the struggle between us and the Arabs. I'm saying this as an historian. I'll change yarmulkes. Has been civilizationally religious from day one. It means we have to stand strong. Unless Yeah, I have a friend who's a Reform rabbi who once said, until there's Reform Islam, there's nothing to talk about. He's right. No, you're absolutely right. Absolutely right. Absolutely right. It is disrespectful to Muslims. Look, we don't make a distinction between politics and religion either. Right? Islam is just like that. There's no such thing as Kodesh and Chol there. Everything is okay? Everything in our lives is affected by Torah. Every aspect of our lives, the way that we, and if the Torah is in its fulfillment, it includes the Mamonis and the Nefoshis and how you build the city and how you build the walls, everything. Lahadal al-Fadal is exactly in Islam that way. There's no such distinction. Everything is the same. Dar al-Islam means a religion. That's, why do you think the push by Muslims around the world for Sharia law? They're not bad people because of that. They think that everybody in the world has got to live according to Sharia, which means their halacha. That's the goal. That's their vision. The fact that the Europeans are so secular and the Americans are so secular they can't figure out that people might actually be seriously religious, that's not my problem. That's their problem. In 1976, Bernard Lewis, Holger Zunzein, he's almost 100 years old, Bernard Lewis published an article and commentary in January 1976 called The Return of Islam, in which he foresaw another wave of Islamic ascendance, because it goes in waves, and everybody thought he was crazy. Everything he wrote in that article in 1976 came true, except for two things. One thing, actually. He said that there were two states that would not fall to the jihadis because they're far too secular. Ready for which ones? Iran and Egypt. Iran, we know, and Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood took power, but they were overthrown by the army. That was the only mistake he made in that article. If you can get a copy of that article, then in commentary, January 1976. There was another question. Yes. Okay. Okay. The Seder? Okay. If you want, you can ask for my email, you can write me a letter.